This interview is brought to you by Cambridge University Press. Please visit Cambridge at www.cambridge.org. There you can find their entire catalog of books. And, of course, you can buy them there as well. So please visit the press today. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week I'm very pleased to say we have John Brook on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Climate Change and the Course of Global History, A Rough Journey. I was telling John before the interview that I've done a little research in what I would call big history. I think he'll call it big history too. And this is a wonderful contribution to big history. And I really look forward to talking to John about it. So let me say welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Marshall. Glad to be here.
Great. So could you kick the interview off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, very briefly, I am an historian, licensed in American history, but background avocation and now occupation, a global historian. I work at Ohio State University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did they teach you the secret handshake when they licensed you?
Pretty much, right.
I didn't ever get the secret handshake. Go Buckeyes, though. As someone who used to teach at Iowa, I can't, you know, that's not so good. So in any event, would you tell us why you wrote Climate Change in the Course of Global History, A Rough Journey?
Well, this is a long story. Yeah, I mean, it does go back to my I recently read my application to graduate school, which I wrote in fall, winter of 1975, and I was applying to an American history program at Penn, and I was thinking in global terms. And when I got to Penn, I was told, look, just put that stuff in the background. We're doing American history here. And that was fine, you know. So I dutifully and actually quite joyfully worked in the vineyards of American history, wrote a couple books. And at that point, having finished my second book, decided, I think I'll go back to my environmental history interests, and my current employer at Tufts University was looking for someone. They were offering they're looking for people to teach in environmental studies. So I launched a course in 1990, did a lot of research summer of 93, and then in the 94-95 academic year started a course in global environmental history. And basically I thought, all right, I'm going to teach one course, and it's not going to be the classic American environmental history, which is a great course, but I just felt we have one globe and one humanity and one big history, and I want to teach it all together. The deep background on this is I did a double major at Cornell in history and anthropology and archaeology in 1974, 40 years ago this summer. Very bizarre to think it's so long ago. I worked the summer on an archaeological site on the Mesolithic, which is, pre-agriculture in Holland, for all summer long. And I had this background in prehistory back into the Paleolithic. So I could handle the big time scales that are involved here. So this course evolved out of that background interest, and then around 2005, I started thinking about writing a book. Mm. And the book evolved from there, and wrote a draft by 2009, and then revised it, and now it's before you.
Well, you're too modest. Perhaps we should say something about the historiographical or even political climate of this book about climate change. Obviously, it's very topical at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, it's interesting to think of how that unfolded in my own thinking. I was obviously concerned about it, and in the backdrop of when I actually started working on the course, I was thinking about it in the late 80s, and I can still remember James Hansen testified in Congress in 1988, and then the idea that greenhouse gases were heating the atmosphere was confirmed through the back door by the cooling effect of Mount Pinatubo explosions in 1993. So obviously, I've had a long-term exposure to and involvement in the science and politics of climate change. I didn't have detailed an understanding of it as I do now, I have to say, quite bluntly. Writing this book was, I was gradually beginning to turn the corner to the interpretation I build in this book, which is, in essence, that not only is climate change obviously incredibly important, but and not only have there been climate change patterns in the past, but they have shaped the course and trajectory of human history. Human history is not isolated from its natural environment. And for most of human history, that means that we have responded to and acted within the framework of natural events. Now, and now is an incredibly short period of time, the last 100 years or so, 140 years perhaps, we are actively, very actively shaping that Earth system environment, that atmospheric environment, and that process has been accelerating massively since literally when I was born. I keep talking about the in my classes. I talk about the micro events of the last 60 years when because in 1958 the first measurements were taken on Mauna Loa of annual changes in CO2 in the atmosphere, and those levels have increased more since 1958 than they had since the 1870s. So the last 50 years, 55 years, the level of atmospheric CO2 has just leapt enormously. So we're scraping, we're at 400 probably sometime. Right about now, I suspect that if we went to the Mauna Loa site, I haven't looked at it in the last couple of days, but we should be, at the 402 weekly level, because that's what happened last year. No reason to think we aren't there now. And what does that mean? 402 parts per million, which I must admit I just pulled that out of the sky. but that's basically what things were, the week of May 28th in 2013. The background numbers for the post-glacial period, the last 10,000 years, oscillating around 280 parts per million. And since, literally since 1958, we have jumped from about 315 to 400. There had been a slight expansion before that, but really the impact of what's happened in the last 50, 60 years is really very stunning.
Mm-hmm. So let's do what historians do best and put some of that in perspective. Your book begins an extraordinarily long time ago. So the universe, I think, is 13.8 billion years old, and the Earth is about 5 million years old, if I recall correctly, 4.8, something like that.
Maybe changed, but I would say 4.56 or something like that.
Don't really know,
years old,
right? And then Earth is and then life is about 4 billion years old.
Something
I'm guessing here.
They are guessing too. That there's many scenarios, and the latest scenarios really are for relatively early emergence of life and frequent extinctions until it finally locked in. Mm-hmm. And yes, obviously enormous time frame. That's part of the lesson of the book and lesson of the way I try to teach it is I teach the entire thing, and I'm afraid my poor students it is a little exhausting, but the logic to this is to see how microscopic our place is in that enormous history, and in fact that the Earth has gone through these incredible environmental crises and transitions that are purely natural, we are, when we talk about reaching 400 parts per million in CO2 in the atmosphere, that level has not been seen in the atmosphere 10 to 38 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, you know, however you want to parse it, is it in the Miocene or is it in the Oligocene? But we're talking about climbing back up an enormous cycle that leads us back to the, literally back to the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs, the peak of the last great greenhouse super cycle that there have been three in the last, 600 million years. The peak of the last greenhouse supercycle, there were dinosaurs roaming the Earth to the North Pole, and the parts per were somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 parts per million in the atmosphere. We have never even vaguely, we have lived, we evolved in a totally different environment. We evolved in increasingly cooler and we might say cleaner greenhouse gas environment. And we're rapidly moving toward, when you talk about doubling and quadrupling scenarios of releasing greenhouse gases suddenly from the Arctic, caused by the accelerating pressure of fossil fuel emissions, we're talking about a shift, a sudden, abrupt transition to conditions that have not been seen in tens and tens of millions of years, and that could happen in a century. And now that's abrupt by geological scales. It might even happen much more abruptly, and that's the problem. People now are talking about years about the possibility of very abrupt shifts taking less than a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arctic ice pattern is looking somewhat like that. I mean, they predicted Arctic ice melting in a long curve that was quite dramatic, but it stretched out into the 21st century. Well, the actual melt-off is moving much, much faster than they expected. And the actual measured decline of Arctic ice is fundamentally dramatic. And that is unprecedented for the Arctic has been glaciated for since 2.5 million years ago began to glaciate. We haven't had a totally deglaciating Arctic for over 2 million years. Keep in mind, the species, anatomically modern humans, are only 200,000 years old. When we think about history, we think about what happened, in World War II. We worry about what happened in World War I. We worry about the shape of the Industrial Revolution. We worry about what, the cause of the Civil War, the cause of the American Revolution. But these are incredibly important political events of the last 8 to 10 generations.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about timescales that take us back 500 to 1500 to 2, 3, 4,000 generations, obviously more. But in terms of Earth systems, we live in an Earth system, and it has its chronologies, and we have ours, and that's part of the disjunction in the current debate, which is people can't really imagine these huge systems shifting that rapidly. And the lesson of the last 30 years in climate science is that these systems do shift that radically, that rapidly, and nobody wants to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally don't really blame them. Who wants to deal with a fundamentally changed world? Nobody really wants it. I mean, nobody really wants it. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants to even think about it. But and certainly not the scientists who discovered it. But the reality is, it is out there, and it's not something that somebody's made up. It's not an unnatural reaction for the first timer coming to the material to be utterly frightened by the specter of what could possibly happen.
Mm-hmm. So let's tell a little bit of the story. Why don't we start with the moment at which, the conditions under which life appeared on Earth. The thesis of the book, if I could say most generally, is that climate, broadly construed, that is the temperature and the condition of the atmosphere, what's in it, mm-hmm. That sort of thing, the amount of water available, methane in the air and oxygen in the air, CO2 in the air. This has had a very important impact on what forms of life evolved, how they evolved, and when they evolved. So this is really the sort of causal moment in the book. So can we begin by talking about the origin of life?
Right. Well, we can. Yeah. I must admit, I do talk about it, but I don't spend a huge amount of time on it. The origins of life are a matter of a debate that I must admit I don't want to get too far into because it's a complex and shifting battlefield. But what is key is what I like to focus on are the wider what I like to call Earth system context of not just the origins of life in its prokaryote forms, but which are the things that are fundamentally obviously that is incredibly important. Though some people argue that some of those prokaryote forms were potentially emerging on other planets, and it's not really that dramatic that they happen. What is dramatic is that the Earth system developed its own structure and history. So the Earth, if we were to do a transect of the Earth, it looks internally different from Mars and Venus because we developed an active living Earth. In other words, the outer and the driver to this is a very simple process, it's simple when you kind of put your head around it, which is that in the outer core of the molten outer core, there is this constant process that's been happening since the beginning of the Earth, which is the sorting out of the elements. And basically, very simply, heavy stuff falls down and light stuff comes up. And so we have this iron nickel core and this process of differentiation of light and heavy elements means that there's we developed a crust on the edges of the Earth. We developed an atmosphere around the outside of the Earth, and then a convection current began to develop inside of that outer core, and that drives enormous. That is the life of the planet, and in the longest terms. And as that system matured, it created context in which which tectonic processes, meaning continents, began to develop and then be subducted. So what I found dramatic is how these the debates about how these processes line up, life evolving in and shifting rapidly from from so-called prokaryote to eukaryote forms, much more cellularly complex forms, in the context of a dramatic, literally events in the Earth system as atmosphere. Let's first focus on the tectonic sort of processes. Those the first eruption of those processes and really continental formations may have set the stage and created the context in which this relatively rapid transition from prokaryote to eukaryote evolved. And then that itself may have contributed to this debate about that. How much did the emergence of oxygen-producing life forms change the atmosphere itself? Mm-hmm. So, and they talk about great oxidation moments, which are taking millions of years, but great oxidation shifts, and they occur at either end of the Proterozoic. So we have a Paleoproterozoic crisis and a Neoproterozoic crisis, and in between a fairly roughly billion and a half years of stability with fairly simple life forms, and then the what I find most dramatic is that Neoproterozoic crisis in which a whiplash of tectonic Earth system geological forces interacting with the atmosphere, interacting with rapidly evolving biology, seems to put the Earth through a series of intense glaciation episodes called the Snowball Earth periods, when the stresses of this whiplash between very warm and very cold conditions over several several tens of millions of years, led to the rise of not just multicellular forms, but, you know, chordates and complex life forms, that visible life forms. Stephen Jay Gould wrote a book years ago called The Burgess Shale about the complex life forms that emerged during this Cambrian period, and a great event-based transition. So one of the things that struck me as I became more, you know, kind of retooled 20 years ago in geology and biology was that you could either look at the evolution of life as a slow mechanistic process, you know, survival of the fittest, essentially a mathematical process by which some random events, random processes unfolded through time and there wasn't much pattern to it. Or it was just a smooth, continuous pattern. Or alternatively, and this was—I mean, I should credit where credit due. Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge proposed a model in the late '70s of punctuated change, mm-hmm. that great events, dramatic events in the Earth system, drove accelerations of evolution. And then very broadly, this is the accepted model these days. That there's a very close connection between the evolution of life as we know it and the evolution of the planet, the specific history of the planet, and that as we can talk about the American Revolution and the Civil War and World War I, World War II, and the rise of parties as, you know, events in American history, but we can also talk about events in Earth history that matter. We all should know about them, and two of them are the Paleoproterozoic crisis and the Neoproterozoic crisis, as well as the origins of life during the Hadean Archean transition.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump forward a little bit and talk about the emergence of humans or humanoids, yeah. or hominins, yeah. or whatever right. we might call them. Yeah. How does the climate play into that? That's right. About 200,000 years ago. We get right. Modern humans or behaviorally modern humans, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, the other way to look at that is to set, you know, ask ourselves, how did we evolve? And Stanley Ambrose wrote a book called Children of the Ice Age, which about the emergence of humanity over the course of the Miocene, the Pliocene, and the Pleistocene, which metaphorically is a wonderful image, and it is a wonderful image. And the backdrop to that is that we are now in geological time in an ice house condition, and there have been we are now in the Cenozoic ice house. There was a Mesozoic ice house, and then there were the ice houses of the end of the Paleoproterozoic, the Paleozoic. My point being broadly that we are a product of a long-term cooling process unfolding over. Since about, you know, it probably began before 65 million years ago, and has been unfolding. You know, it's part of an internal cycle to the Earth system. Certainly accelerated by various processes, but the rise of humanity can be. Broadly patterned, it's patterned by very significant events in the this long-term cooling that's been unfolding over these millions of years. So we don't get into mammalian evolution, but at all, this whole cooling process has led to the rise of mammals and other aspects of the modern biosphere that we take for granted. And then we came along in under, you know, certain specific pressures in eastern Africa during the Miocene, Pliocene, and Pleistocene. So benchmark points being, you know, the onset of Arctic glaciation, among others, at 2.5 million, probably led to the drought conditions in eastern Africa, acceleration of need for habitat stress and some kind of adaptive reaction. And one of those adaptive reactions was pre-human populations beginning to use tools more effectively and to scavenge kill sites where big cats, lions have killed large animals out on the savannah and get fat for their children. Brain size expanded, and we get smarter, small, hobbit-like, so-called Homo habilis emerging out of that. A great transition unfolding, whether or not this has a climate effect now or not, that's unknown, but the emergence of fire, controlled fire, now dated to about 1 million years ago from a site in South Africa, a major transition, which leads to fundamentally the modern human physique of a relatively large head and a relatively small stomach. We don't have a huge stomach because we pre-digest our food. We cook it. And that's been going on for 1 million years. And then the specifics of modern human emergence out of, over the course of, from 2.5 or from 5 million, if you want to go back to Australopithecus, specific climate pressures in Eastern Africa driving adaptive change and increasingly change that led to an increasingly generalist approach, essentially beginning to under rather than being specifically committed to one strategy, being able to figure out different strategies to make a living, to survive and to reproduce. But it looks pretty clear that there were, if we think about the origins of modern humanity, as you were asking about 200,000 years ago, very, very intense droughts in Eastern Africa leading to very small bottlenecks of human population out of which, in which, with very reduced populations, particular genetic traits spread very fast. And in the wake of these mega droughts, we have the first evidence of anatomically modern humans in Eastern Africa at 190 and 160 in the earliest modern human sites in Ethiopia, which is a very dramatic moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump forward again, and our time periods are getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
I'm sure the listener will notice things are speeding up. So let's jump forward again to what I think is the most – I don't know what's the most interesting, but I was going to use the word confused because we don't exactly know what's going on, and there's been a lot of scholarly attention to it. That is the origin of – and I don't even know what to call it. There's so much debate going on. Sedentism, agriculture, horticulture,
right.
Cities.
You
pick one.
Well, therein lies, it's pretty clear that, agriculture was, it's probable that agriculture was pretty much impossible during the ice ages. When you have CO2 down there during the ice ages, CO2 was at about 180, and there is a pretty good 180 parts per million, and a pretty good argument to be made that those conditions, people have done experiments, simply agriculture was impossible. What is striking is how rapidly agriculture begins to develop as soon as the conditions shift. And so we have a combination during the last warm-up, which happened. First, we have a brief period of warmth that lasted about 1,000 years, and then a cold 1,000 years of cold, the Younger Dryas, where things suddenly cooled down again, caused by the impact of fresh water into the North Atlantic, stopping great ocean currents and shutting the whole system down again. You have to think of the system of warmth that's driven by massive ocean currents as well as by atmospherics. And the ocean currents stopped suddenly, and because of fresh water suddenly being dropped out of the melting glaciers into the North Atlantic, and it took about 1,000 years to recover. But as that transition, as things warm up fairly rapidly, about 9600 BC, we then get movement toward agriculture in particular locations and in under what circumstances. That's therein lies the problem. It's probable that as soon as things warm up, people tend to settle in, even without agriculture. They simply settle into places with high biomass productivity, where the particularly regions that are swampy and wet that produce a lot of good things to eat. And this is called the Mesolithic. This is a period where they are, and a lot of Mesolithic societies survived into the recent past, and basic societies that were hunter-gatherer societies that were not farming. Those societies were, in many cases, actually sedentary because they had no need to move, or they moved much less than we expect them. That we thought they might. They might move, from, you know, seasonally in a small tribal range. and the transition to full-scale agriculture is something that really does take, by human history time perspective, quite a bit of time. It takes about 4,000 or 5,000 years. And even in the places where it moves most rapidly, which is in China and in Southwest Asia, meaning the Fertile Crescent, what is now Syria, Iraq, and Israel and Lebanon. It is a complex story. It's not a simple story, but it's one that really has two phases. One, the experimentation with horticulture in a society that increasing dependence on horticulture, particularly involving women's labor. It looks pretty clear that women are doing that work and men were still hunting and herding. And then a transition to full-scale, what we call traditional peasant agriculture, sometime between 6,000 BC and 4,000 BC in both China and in Southeast Asia. By 4,000, 3,000 BC, you have societies that are, we could more or less handle. I mean, they would be pretty strange if we dropped into them, but anybody who's kind of got a back understanding of, you know, people live in mud-walled cities and mud-walled villages, and they use cattle for various things, and there's no electricity. conditions like this were not existed in the 20th century. It wouldn't be impossible to live in these contexts. And the climate context for that really is one, the warmer conditions, but two, what I stress in the middle part of my book is not just that the Holocene, which is the last 10,000 years, has been a warm period, but it has had a pattern to it. And so much of my story, my analysis, is about the pattern of climate change since the end of the Ice Ages. That is nowhere near as deep as the patterns of the Pleistocene and of the grand structures of Earth history running back to the origins of the Earth. But it has a pattern, and those patterns have affected the health and the welfare of human societies as they become more and more dependent on agriculture and become more and more concentrated in the exciting places like cities. Cities are a fun place to live, but they're also they have an environmental footprint, and they're also a dangerous place to live because people tend to get sick there in the not so distant past. So much of the book is focused on the shape of climate change in a fairly specific century-by-century analysis to argue that it has a pattern, and those patterns relate to periods of fluorescence and periods of crisis in the history of agricultural societies over the last 8,000 to 9,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that pattern. I mean, I should also say for the careful listener will obviously have noted that we have now crossed the boundary into what historians would call historical time, because now
right.
we have written
right.
documents. This is usually
right.
where your Western and Eastern civ classes will begin.
Right.
And so we're adding a new layer on those and trying to explain some of what we see in the record. So there'll be – actually, we can talk about familiar historical events now, not only the rise of cities in the Near East, but actual empires, the Greek Golden Age and then the Romans, so on and so forth. I'm sorry to be so Western-centric. But go ahead and talk about that pattern and take us through that.
Right.
It's really quite a short period.
We can
actually sensibly speak about it.
It's
quite a short period of 3,000 or 4,000 years. So go ahead.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's sometimes easier to do this visually, but
yeah.
We can't. But in essence, we have to think of the last 4,000 to 5,000 years as already a cooler period than what had occurred previous to that. The period from the sudden warm up and actually very warm, beneficent climates, much, much warmer than they are now, running from, 8,500 BC to about 4,000 BC. And that's called the early Holocene. We live, then there was a mid Holocene crisis, and then we live in broadly the late Holocene. And over the last 5,000 years, we can describe from the data produced by the climate scientists, we can describe visually and on paper a pattern that roughly unfolds over 2,200 years. They're called Hallstatt solar minima. And so these Hallstatt solar minima, which broadly means that the sun has an oscillation to it. And so it's solar shifts are extremely important. And there is an active analysis of how the solar output has evolved over the last 10,000 years. And it's, once we get cool enough for those solar influences to become significant, happening around 5,000 years ago, they determine the course and pulse of human welfare, really. So, okay, when did these happen? One of these Hallstatt minima occurred around 4,000 to 3,000 BC. Then we jump forward to about 1,200 to about 800 BC. And today is May 28th. Today's New York Times had an editorial about the crisis of the Bronze Age, 1,200 BC. Which was the onset of a Hallstatt solar minima period that lasted for 400 or 500 years. So we have two there, and then we have the third one happened in relatively recent time. It's called the Little Ice Age, and it began, the first hints of it were around 1260, 1275 AD. It reached its depths, around 15, it suddenly got much, much severe around 1560, and all during the 17th century, we have historically low periods, including the so-called Maunder minimum of the late 17th century, when people were beginning to look at the sun with telescopes and burn their eyes, and they started looking at the sun, and slowly they started seeing sunspots, and there hadn't been any. And they started counting sunspots and realized that. And over time, well, Mr. Maunder in about 40 years ago realized that they were what they had seen was a minimum when there had been no sunspots and it was solar flares were very low and solar activity was very low, thus correlating with an extremely cold period.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the solar patterns and then we have the effects on Earth, and one of the most dramatic of them is something called the Siberian High. The Siberian High pattern produces a signature in the Greenland ice cores of Asian dust, basically a very particular kind of sulfur with a particular kind of chemical signature oscillates and ripples along, and then lining up with the Hallstatts goes into these extreme patterns, which suggest extreme cold, stormy weather in the Northern Hemisphere. These are described as what they would influence, say, the Mediterranean or China would be, or Japan, intense winter polar outbursts, And I wouldn't want to call reference to the vortex events of the last year, which are minimal compared to what these things were like. And actually, in the last phase of the Little Ice Age, the French historians have found that they can go through journals and actually map these solar outbursts, these Siberian high outbursts, on the landscape, from journal diaries of priests writing about cold, snowy events in southern France, and track them day by day. And these things line up exactly to the year with the, annual data from the Greenland ice cores. Mm. So really, you know, you got some amazing correlation. So broadly speaking, the pattern is, if we just look at, say, the last 3,000 years, we came out of the Siberian high, desperate cold drought circumstances of that late Bronze Age Hallstatt, which basically destroyed the Bronze Age. This is the point of the editorial today, that the Bronze Age was destroyed by a Bronze Age, both in the Mediterranean world, and having global effects. I mean, you can see these patterns everywhere. Because the climate system, which again it's hard to describe on the telephone, but the knee bone is connected to the thigh bone. A cold north means droughts in India and southwest southern Asia, and it means El Nino storminess on the west coast of the Americas. So there literally is a system. It all fits together. And so broadly speaking, over the last 5,000 years, we've had this oscillation between either a warm north and good monsoons in India and China, and the pretty dry Americas, or the reverse, very cold north, not Pleistocene cold, but cold, Little Ice Age cold, and droughts in India. Droughts in on the eastern end of what's called the El Nino Southern Oscillation Band that runs across the Pacific, and it's strong El Nino storminess and floods and disaster in oscillating with intense droughts. I mean, variation in El Nino gets extreme, and so South America went through intense drought and flood conditions, oscillating wildly during these Hallstatt periods. So that's the background. We are in an optimum. We are in an optimum where we are not in a Hallstatt minimum. We came out of one probably there's something called the Dalton minimum, which happened around 1810 to 1820. That's the last of the Little Ice Age minima, a last horn blowing of that cycle in the soul, in the internal workings of the sun, which, you know, created cold conditions in the turn of the early 19th century. But since then, solar influence has been higher to some degree, higher, and we're in an optimum, not unlike the Roman Empire and the Han Empire were in an optimum. I mean, really simply, the Roman Empire is bracketed by the great ages of empire in both the Mediterranean, Southwest Asian world, and in Han China, is distinctly bracketed by the optimum conditions of roughly 200 BC to 280. And then what you have is a secondary pattern. In between these grand minima, there are secondary minima, and one of them shaped the Dark Ages of this broadly 400-450 AD to about 900 AD of a moderately cold period, and that there's all sorts of consensus emerging that had its decisive effect on the decline of the Roman Empire. Broadly, the shift toward colder temperatures and wetter conditions broadly in Europe, undermined the wheat economy that underlay the wheat, wine, oil economy that underwrote the Roman Empire. You couldn't grow the stuff as far north as you could and as had before, and it undermined the economic basis of the outer edges of the empire. Mm-hmm. And then if you go to China, China has a very complicated climate history, which doesn't quite fit exactly this model, but because of the influence, there's a complication of how the monsoons are shaped by both the Indian Ocean and the Siberian High and the events in the North Pacific. But what is pretty clear and really quite amazing is every single dynastic crisis in Chinese history, as far back as you want to go, is shaped by can be aligned with a dramatic drop, a crisis in the climate. It doesn't mean that every climate drop caused a crisis in an imperial crisis in China, but every imperial crisis is connected to a climate crisis. Yeah, yeah. And very simply, the Mandate Heaven is withdrawn. The crops fail. The drought or floods if impact crops. Crops fail. People get hungry. People start to the brigands emerge, and the dynasty falls. And every now and then, in the Middle Ages, the Mongols came out of the north.
Mm-hmm.
The nomads came out of the north and created some very dramatic, specific events in China's incredible history.
Mm-hmm. I know historians don't like to make predictions, or as a professor of mine used to say, don't like to make predictions, especially about the future.
Especially about the future. We only predict about the past, right?
So this cycle is coming back around.
Yeah.
Yes, it's coming back around. When is it scheduled to arrive?
Well, you know, the Hallstatt super minima is well beyond our worries. You know, the Hallstatt pattern, if we haven't overwhelmed it by our own, mm-hmm. I mean, it's highly likely that we've overwhelmed the natural signal because you have to imagine a very warm period in the early Holocene, 9,000 BC to about 6,000 BC. Solar influence didn't matter as much. It had to do with how the Earth was tilted toward the sun, and it created a very warm northern hemisphere, and solar influences are, you know, they're there, but they're not significant. Once the orbital structure, basically the orbit, when I talk about orbital structure, that means the way the Earth is oriented toward the sun, either by its tilt or by the shape of the orbit, or by where the seasons are in a cycle. The seasons shift around the orbit. So these are called the Milankovitch cycles, and they operate on different periodicities. And the one that matters for us is precession, and we have been, you know, moving toward a cooler pattern that allowed these solar cycles to have an effect starting around 5,000 years ago. So my position would be this, that we are creating, the natural cycles will continue, they'll keep rolling around, but we are doing to the climate, we are changing the climate system. So those natural signals may not have the same effects that they would have in the past, since we put, we doubled, we haven't quite doubled the CO2 in the atmosphere quite yet, but we are moving toward it. We have increased it by a third. We've increased the pressure on the system, and we certainly have moved global temperatures higher and changed the structure of the climate system. I mean, what we're dealing with right now in terms of prediction, how do we predict the future? We're dealing with a natural system that has been perturbed, that has been altered, and so that complicates predictions. Is the cycle coming around? The next Hallstatt is probably going to come, or what shall we say, probably in about let's do the math here. We'll say 2,000 years from 1700, so 2,700. I'm not too worried about 2,000. Is that right? 2,700? No, that's not even right. That's from 1700 to 3,700.
3,700, yeah.
3,700. Not something to worry about. The intermediate half cycle, again, nothing really to worry about. But there's plenty of, there are predictions. There is a debate going on now about what smaller scale solar minima might evolve. They're trying to study the last, what they can of how the chemistry of the solar flares hitting the atmosphere and being deposited into the glaciers. They study that chemistry through time, and they try to analyze the cycle pattern. And so they're trying to predict what will happen in the next 100 to 200 years. There is a prediction that we might have a solar cycle pattern that isn't a grand pattern, but it'll be a cooler pattern. It's a prediction that sometime in the next century we would have a respite from the pressures we're putting on the system. But on the other hand, it may be that signal doesn't even register, because we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere so much in the last 170 years, 140 years, since I like to benchmark it at 1870. Mm-hmm. And that's the point of massive transition, fundamental transition. The emissions numbers just leap off the charts. So, yes, there's an industrial revolution before that, but it's nothing like, it doesn't have the fossil fuel impacts that we start to get from the 1870s forward. So 140 years of really dramatic change, and we don't know where we are. That's the fundamental problem. And so what the climate scientists have been trying to do, generating amazing data for me then to use for another purpose to interpret the human past, they have been trying to figure out how we can map what the natural system is to figure out how far we have gone from the natural system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I could ask a quick question about the historian's contribution to the climate change debate. And we can take ice core samples, and we can find out how much CO2 was in the air 100, 200, 300, 400 years ago, and we see this big spike starting mid-19th century. Does that correspond to anything we see in the historical record in terms of a change of fuel or an increase in the amount of fuel or increase in the consumption of fuel? Or can it be tracked in that way?
Right.
For example, you could today say, well, there were this many cars in 1960 and there are this many cars today, and you see that tracks very nicely with the increase in CO2. So is there anything from the 19th century that we can point to?
What we're seeing there is the leap into we're really talking about coal. And coal has the burning of coal, the acceleration of the burning of coal around the North Atlantic and elsewhere is the dramatic shift. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, if you look at what does the historian bring to the table? The historian brings to the table the economic history and the population history, which this climate scientist really desperately don't know anything about. They really want this analysis because now they can see what the correlates are, because they are extremely good at what they do, but they don't have time to do the history part. That's what we bring to the table. And a lot of what we bring to the table has to be fairly traditional economic history. And then layered into that is, new data that people down at Oak Ridge, a national laboratory, have been able to generate in the last a decade or so of an analysis of how the source of emissions. So I've basically correlated those emissions data that they have developed from understandings of how economies have worked and the amount of fossil fuels being burned in different capacities. And what's very clear is that in the 1870s, as we're getting a transition, particularly, if you want a specific moment in American history, it's when Andrew Carnegie fires up the Bessemer plants in Pittsburgh in 1873. We move to a very cheap way to make steel, that involves huge amount of coal being burned, reduced to coke, and coke being used in these massive systems to produce the infrastructure that we live in right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the infrastructure that we live in and is degrading all around us, of steel bridges and sewer lines, whatever, and steel buildings, emerged. Having looked at all this data, basically the mid-19th century was an environmental crisis in the sense of people were piling into these ramshackle cities and which were exploding, built out of wood, and we needed a safe city. So over the course of the late 19th century, massive industrialization to build the safe city, which has electricity, which has sewer lines, which has steel buildings, a fireproof city. And that drove required massive amounts of coal burning. By the turn of the century, you can even talk about the transition to gas, gasoline, petroleum versus coal as an environmental measure, because it actually reduced, cleaned up the atmosphere to some degree. As you make a transition to away already in the you increase the amount of energy BTUs coming out of coal relative to the entire economy, the GDPs in the economy that are producing, the emissions per GDP go down because you're using cleaner fuels, even at the turn of the, even in the 1920s and 30s. But clearly the whole system is getting, is expanding dramatically. What we also bring to the table is an analysis of economic supercycles. And if you go on the web and you look for the term, modern supercycle, it'll bring you to an analysis of the modern economy with one big supercycle expansion from the 1870s to the beginning of World War One, a contraction that runs from World War One to the end of World War Two, and then another huge supercycle expansion that leads down to when I was a sophomore in college, 1973, and then a contraction that would shape much of our adult lives. And now we are in the midst of possibly a third supercycle expansion based on East Asia and based on electronics and not electronics, should we say, high tech and biotech, but massive production going on in Eastern Asia. So each one of these expansions has produced enormous amounts of CO2 and sulfates, which have masked the effects of the CO2. So there's a very complicated story about how global warming has happened in the last 100 years, which has been that actually during these supercycle expansions, we put gigantic amounts of CO2, which lasts for a long period of time in the atmosphere, decades to centuries, and we also put up sulfates. And the sulfates last for, like little mini volcanoes. And so we burn coal, we burn oil, and it puts up a mask of sulfate that actually has a cooling effect regionally. So if you look at the Earth from the modeling, and there are actually cooler strips. One of them is actually Mid-America. It's actually kind of cooler. And there's, there are three of them. One of them is Mid-America out in the Atlantic. Another is Europe stretching into Russia. And another is this big smear of cooling coming out of China. These are the sulfate emissions that create local cooling effects. So the Arctic is burning up. The equator is warming up. The sea level is rising from a variety of contexts, not just ice melting, but just simply warmer water means an expanded volume in the oceans. So there's all sorts of dynamics going on there but what's dramatic is when you reduce the sulfates, which create acid rain, so we kind of want to reduce the sulfates. The Soviet Union collapses in 1990. You suddenly have a spike in warming. So right now, we are actually what's called a hiatus. Warming has plateaued. since about the year 2002 or so, plus or minus. And people are pointing at that and saying, what's going on there? Well, what is going on there seems to be that China is putting an enormous, if you look at the emissions from China, they have simply leapt up. They were flat through the 1970s. They began to climb slightly in the, significantly, but not, not dramatically, on Deng Xiaoping reforms, 1970s, 80s, into the 90s. And then in 2002, they simply leap straight up. And so, if there's a great historical moment, one is Bessemer steel in the 1870s, another is 2002, and the launch of the sudden sort of phase shift in the Chinese economy. And that may, in fact, be shaping a plateau in the increase of warming that had been skyrocketing in the previous 25 years, because so many more sulfates are in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the problem of how to we are now, in a situation where we don't just manage our households and manage our towns and cities and our countries. We have to manage the globe. And not everybody wants to do that. Not everybody can see the patterns and accepts the idea of the patterns that drive this analysis. But very clearly, we have interfered in the Earth system to the degree that we are responsible for its safe management. We have to figure out ways to turn the thermostat, and one of those is to radically control the burning of coal. There's many other things we have to worry about, but the burning of coal is very, very high, because that's the key culprit. Around the edges, we may be able to cut down on black soot and cut down on methane, and they may take enough percentages out to allow us to squeak through. And that's the issue now, is how much do we contain the warming over the next century? For what kind of a world do we give to our grandchildren? What kind of a world do we leave to the people who come after us? I study American history and my other life, and in the past, people have spent a lot of time worrying publicly about what country shall we leave to our children, what country shall we leave to our grandchildren. Well, now we have to think about what world do we leave to our children and grandchildren. And those of us who are those of you out there who are under 40, there's a lot of unhappiness and concern about what a mess they've inherited. And so what we have to do is we have to break the political logjam, and that really does involve a political process that involves interests. Cheap energy is good. Cheap energy is nice, and it makes my life easier. And but it comes at a cost, and that cost may be beyond what we can handle.
It reminds me of what someone, I think they were trying to be funny, but there's an element of truth that the best way to limit your consumption of things is not to consume.
It's high impact man. My wife's just reading this. He had an impact man, I think.
Right. So anyway, thank you very much for writing the book, and thank you for putting all of this in context. It's a terrific book. We've been talking with John Brook about climate change and the course of global history, a rough journey. So John, let me close the interview by asking you our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, I am doing a variety of things. One thing I'm doing is writing a little blog that I'm putting on gradually. It'll take putting a few blogs up and probably doing this once every 2 or 3 weeks on the Cambridge site, to kind of keep commentary on current events and my book. So if you want to go there, it'll be continuing text thoughts about where we are. But I'm also kind of shifting back to American history, and I'm working on a project slowly starting in 2010 and now more and more accelerated on what I consider to be the causes of the Civil War, basically the causes of the American Civil War have to be seen, you know, in a shift in Northern public opinion. The South would defend slavery no matter what. So the problem is, when does the North suddenly, and I would suggest it is a sudden process in the early 1850s, change enough of the North changes opinion to scare the South into seceding. So it's a very specific analysis of how culture and politics interact. So I'm trying to bridge a gap between cultural history and political history, focus on the early 1850s, Harriet Beecher Stowe and even Stephen Foster, a songwriter, played a key role in here. So I'm looking, instead of having just done a project that took me into thousands and tens of thousands and millions and billions of years, now I'm looking at months and days in the early 1850s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you luck with that project. Let me tell everyone again that we've been talking with John Brooke about his book, Climate Change and the Course of Global History, A Rough Journey, just out from Cambridge. I hope everybody has a chance to go and look at the book and perhaps buy it. I really encourage you to do that. So, John, let me thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah.
And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast and all the podcasts on the New Books Network, thank you very much for your support and for listening in, and I hope everybody has a great week.